Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to join us here to discuss and to ponder what is the aim of education. And today we actually have one kind of answer to this question: flourishing as the aim of education. And of course we can answer to this question in ways. But today the perspective is more or less on flourishing. My name is Hannu Heikkinen, and I'm working as a professor in Finnish Institute for Educational Research in this building in University of Jyväskylä. And I'm leading the Academy of Finland project entitled Wisdom in Practice, and this project is the main organizer of this event. The project aims at doing research on wisdom, and the aim is shortly to investigate how professionals face wicked problems and on that basis to develop pedagogy in higher education to prepare graduates capable of addressing sustainability problems and promoting planetary well-being in the everyday in their everyday work. And this project is divided into three work packages, and each of the work packages tell something about the perspectives that we do our research. The work package one is about the theories and philosophies. It's about conceptualizing wisdom in practice. And of course, one of the our starting points is what is called phronesis, which is the word that Aristotle used for practical wisdom. And this work package is led by myself and my colleague Eva Kallio. And then the work package two is an empirical one. And the aim is to investigate wisdom in professional practice, and we are doing interviewing not only in Finland but also in Australia and in Switzerland. And the work package leader of this WP2 is Marit Virolainen. And you can wave your hand so everybody knows that Marit is there. Okay. And then the work package three is developing wisdom in higher education, led by Professor Päivi Tynjälä. And Päivi is up there. Alrighty. Thank you. So, on behalf of our project, it will be then myself, Eva Kallio, and Christian Christensen. Eva will introduce Christensen a little bit later. But this is also, I would say, a historical moment, because we have these three interdisciplinary schools here with us today as well. And well, depending on definition, the eldest maybe could be JYU Wisdom, which is the School of Resource Wisdom. And this JYU Wisdom is celebrating its fifth anniversary very soon in June this year. And on behalf of JYU Wisdom, we have Professor Sanna Karkulehto here as discussant after Christian Christensen's speech. And then the second eldest, again, depending on definition, is the JYU Well, which is the School of Well-Being. And on behalf of this school, we have Katja Kokko here. Welcome, Katja. And then the newest, or actually it might be also the eldest, is JYU Edu. It's a community for teacher education, development, and research. And on behalf of JYU Edu, we have Mira Kalalahti. Welcome, Mira. But actually, if we take a closer look at this, maybe we could say this is actually the eldest. Because this university actually was founded as teacher education seminar. So we would actually say that this is the eldest one. But anyway, we can argue about that later. Alrighty. But it's a wonderful event indeed, and very exciting. And one of the reasons actually is that flourishing seems to be a very topical issue today. And Eva, why this is so urgent and topical today?
Thank you, Hannu. Actually, OECD, which has arranged PISA researches so far, and in which our institute, Finnish Institute for Educational Research, has had a prominent role in the latest decades. So OECD has launched another project called High-Performing Systems for Tomorrow. And flourishing is included in this project very intimately. It explores purposes of education, and especially how human and all other systems on Earth flourish in the future. We face enormous transformations in hand and in decades, future decades. We are in the midst of revolution, or AI, and global environmental challenges. But also there's a question, what is human being? What are the values and images of human being which we should progress via education in the future? If AI takes more and more our demands in the future, what is the role on human being and scholars, actually? These are existential questions. And so OECD has launched Education for Flourishing project, and the first part of it, I think, has been already done in the last few years, and a few more projects are coming in the future in a few years. And now next, it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Christian Christiansson. He's a professor of character education and virtue ethics, and he's a deputy director of the Jubilee Center for Character and Virtues, University of Birmingham, UK. He's a neo-Aristotelic scholar. He has both focus on wisdom research and flourishing and value education. And he's currently a main editor of Journal of Moral Education. Besides his numerous scientific articles, he has written books like Virtues and Vices in Positive Psychology and Flourishing as the Aim of Education, a Neo-Aristotelian View. So, Christian, the floor is yours. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Eva, and thank you, Hannu, for your kind introduction and for inviting me to speak here. Can you all hear me well? Okay, good. So I will be giving you a presentation about flourishing as the aim of education. It's partly based on my book, which I wrote in 2020, but I've never written a book that has become so outdated so quickly, because when I wrote it, flourishing was being discussed by academics, but it didn't really have much practical traction. And the policymakers were not that interested at all. So I wrote this book mainly as an academic exercise, and I was expecting the main readers to be other academics in education, in psychology, and in philosophy. Although I did include two or three sort of practical questions for teachers at the end of each chapter, so I tried to make the book readable for practitioners as well, but it was mainly an academic exercise. But then after 2020, a lot has happened. Certainly UNESCO and OECD have come on board, and there are all kinds of projects now in policy circles about flourishing as the new aim of education, possibly taking over from the human capital theory, which has been the dominant model by these United Nations institutions since the 1980s. So I will be sort of giving you an overview of some themes from my book, but also discussing 10 remaining problems that I think this view of education still faces. And many of these problems I didn't really think about clearly enough until after I had published the book. So there is quite a lot of new material here that you won't find in the book, and obviously also relate to this recent practical development. Right, so this interest in flourishing as the aim of education in academia, and I say in academia, not in sort of practical policy circles, goes back to the beginning of this century, and it goes back to a number of well-known educational philosophers on both sides of the Atlantic who started to write about the need to introduce a new aim for education worldwide. And just to give you a few examples, Harry Brickhouse is an American educational philosopher, quite well known in the States. And he argues that the purpose of education is to promote human flourishing. John White is an eminent retired educational philosopher in the UK. And he talks about schools as seedbeds of human flourishing. And in the Netherlands, Dorette de Ruyter focuses on the universal hopes of parents that their children will lead a flourishing life. So a lot of questionnaires and surveys around the world have shown that what parents are really concerned about their children's education is that they are happy and flourish at school. So, but there are various problems. The first one is that flourishing is a Greek concept. It's a translation of the Greek term eudaimonia, which goes back to Aristotle. And Aristotle was the first philosopher to write about eudaimonia, or flourishing, as the aim not only of education but of life in general. But it so happens that these three philosophers, they are all liberal thinkers. They would not define themselves as Aristotelians or Neo-Aristotelians. They are liberal thinkers. So this is a bit odd because there is a huge gap between liberalism and Aristotelianism. So, for example, liberals tend to endorse a very, very small common core of universal values and virtues like tolerance, freedom, the right to private property, etc. Whereas Aristotelians tend to believe that people all over the world sort of exhibit or endorse a fairly large sort of set of universal virtues, compassion, justice, courage, generosity, etc. So this is a big difference. And then the second problem is that not only are these liberal thinkers writing about flourishing as the aim of education, and also obviously the Neo-Aristotelians like myself, but there are also two groups within psychology that are suddenly become very interested in flourishing in the last 20 to 30 years. That's both people within so-called self-determination theory, people like Ryan and Deasy, and then people in positive psychology, in particular Martin Seligman, who wrote a very famous bestseller about flourishing in 2011, where he introduced a so-called PERMA model of flourishing. So the second problem is that what does this word really mean? If people coming from such different backgrounds in politics and in academia are all sort of promoting the same ideal, do they mean the same thing, or are they just talking about very different concepts, although they happen to be using the same word? And then suddenly, after I wrote my book, and I was completely unaware of this at the time, suddenly there is this great interest in flourishing in policy circles, both within UNESCO and OECD. Now, some of you may know that UNESCO and OECD have always been at loggerheads about education for decades. They've been fighting. So UNESCO has always sort of had much more humanistic ideas about the aims of education, whereas OECD has always sort of pursued a very economically based hardline policy with a focus on STEM subjects. And the official OECD policy since the 1980s has been the so-called human capital theory, according to which the aims of education are mainly economical: prosperity for individuals and prosperity for nations, basically. In 2022, UNESCO published a huge report about flourishing as the aim of education. That's not surprising, really, because, I mean, that sort of follows their old humanistic trend. So they've always been much more interested in philosophy than OECD. But then suddenly OECD is now coming on board as well, and Michael Stevenson, for example, wrote this report that Hanu mentioned before. So now suddenly there is this great interest among OECD countries. And surprisingly, the pressure on OECD to change its human capital theory is not coming from the countries that score lowest in PISA comparison. It's coming from the countries that score highest, especially from Singapore, Hong Kong, South Korea, and to some extent from Finland as well. And the reason given, especially by the Asian countries, is that they say, well, it's really nice that we always score so high in PISA every year, but there is so much dissatisfaction among our students in school, and the suicide rate is very high. There's an epidemic of psychological disorders. So there must be something wrong that we are doing in schools, despite scoring so high in literacy and numeracy year after year. So it's not really an internal sort of philosophical kind of inspiration within OECD. It's this pressure coming from these countries for OECD to change its overall philosophy of education. And at the moment, there are four reports under construction. I wrote a report for OECD, and the Human Flourishing Center at Harvard is working on a measure of instrument to measure the flourishing for OECD, which I tend to be a little bit skeptical about, but we can talk more about that in the discussion if you want to. Right, so I'm not going to go into very much deep philosophy here or conceptual studies, but many of you will know that there are two main sort of theories about what well-being is in the history of philosophy going back 2,300 years. One is that well-being is subjective. It's happiness. It's feeling pleased, feeling happy, glad, pleased. And then the other kind of well-being theories is the objective accounts, according to which well-being is mainly about objective variables like purpose in life, health, etc. Now, the flourishing as the aim of education is usually considered to be an objective account of well-being. So it's about objective variables. But maybe that doesn't really matter that much, because there is a very, very strong correlation between objective and subjective measures. So the correlation is up to 60-70%. So people who score high, for example, students who score high on objective well-being tend to score high on subjective well-being, and vice versa. Although there are statistical outliers, I will talk about that a little bit later. Now, both these theories have got their own problems, and again, I'm not going to be spending a lot of time on that. The problem with subjective accounts of well-being is that, according to the subjective accounts, if we just could give students every day when they come to school a pill and they would be smiling and happy the whole day, then they would be enjoying well-being, according to the subjective accounts. And that sounds really strange. We wouldn't really think of children who are just high on some pleasure pill to be experiencing well-being, nor would we think of a happy slave as a person enjoying well-being. But the objective accounts have got their problems as well, because it seems to be a bit strange for a theorist to say, well, you score high on all these objective variables. You had good parents, you went to a good school, you got a good job, you got a good partner, you got healthy children, you got this nice Range Rover out there. But you happen to be depressed or unhappy. So it sounds a bit paternalistic to say to a person you are experiencing well-being if the person is not feeling subjectively happy. So there are problems with both these accounts. But the point here is that flourishing tends to be categorized more as an objective rather than a subjective account of well-being. Although, obviously, we hope that if we can help children to flourish in the classroom, they will also be happy. And in most cases, they probably will. Now, I could spend the whole 40 minutes on just this one slide, but I will again go through it very quickly. It just shows you what I consider to be the main pros and cons of these different accounts of flourishing. So in my book, I'm trying to, although the book is written from an Aristotelian or a neo-Aristotelian perspective, because that's where I come from, but I do acknowledge various weaknesses in the Aristotelian account, and I talk about the pros and cons of the three other main accounts of flourishing. And I try to come up with some kind of a synthesis where I try to maximize the strengths and minimize the weaknesses of these different accounts. So just to go through this very quickly, the old Aristotelian account is very, very strong on flourishing, on the moral and rational and emotional and communal aspects of human flourishing. But Aristotle had no concept of individual purpose or autonomy. These are Enlightenment concepts. They didn't exist in ancient Greece. So if we think of children finding an individual purpose in their lives, like Greta Thunberg has done with her environmental ideal, if we think of that as a part of human flourishing, then you won't find much about that in Aristotle, because he simply didn't have that concept. It didn't exist. And also Aristotle is very, very weak on anything spiritual or transcendental. So if you think that to flourish, children need to experience awe and elevation and be drawn to ideals, could be environmental ideals or political ideals or religious ideals, again, you won't find much about that in Aristotle. He was a very practically minded guy. The liberal accounts, obviously, because they are liberal, they are based in Enlightenment ideas, they're very strong on individual human purpose, on children, trying to help children find purpose behind their lives, which is individually adjusted. But on the other hand, the liberal accounts are very weak on anything related to character, strengths, and virtues, because they don't really believe that there are any universal character, strengths, and virtues. So again, that's pretty understandable as a weakness. Self-determination theory talks a lot about psychological needs, that you need to satisfy your needs for autonomy, for relationships, for competence, and children won't flourish at school unless they can satisfy these needs. That sounds plausible and reasonable, but there is very little about reason or rationality in SDT. So it doesn't really seem to think that people have a need to exercise their rational capacities. In positive education, in the PERMA model, for example, from Martin Seligman, there is a lot about awe and elevation, about positive emotions, about meaning-making, etc. But the normative grounding of the theory is very weak. So there is very little about sort of what is really universally valuable. Martin Seligman says, well, I don't know what is universally valuable. I only know what is generally valued by people. So he just surveys people and asks them what they value in life. And there's another problem in positive psychology or positive education, which is that it has this famous list of 24 character strengths and virtues that teachers are supposed to help children develop at school. But there is no concern about conflicts. Personally, I think the main problem that we face on a daily basis is not so much to choose whether to be bad or good. It's to choose what to do when there's a conflict. For example, when I can't be both honest and compassionate at the same time. Shall I tell the truth or not? And you see this with children a lot. They face problems when they are teenagers about honesty to teachers versus loyalty to friends. And there is nothing in positive psychology to help us to sort of adjudicate conflicts between these different values. So this is a very, very brief account of these four main philosophical and psychological theories of flourishing, that they've all got their pros and cons. So like I said, I tried in my book to aim for a synthesis. I begin with the Aristotelian account, but I point out the weaknesses and say, well, if we want to make this an educational aim for schools around the world, then we need to obviously update Aristotle with recent findings, both conceptual and empirical. So just to continue with the problems, I said earlier that there's a strong correlation between objective and subjective features of well-being. That's true, but there are still outliers even if a teacher manages to create the perfect learning conditions in a classroom and making all the children flourish as students, 29 of the 30 will be very happy as well, but there's always going to be one who is still unhappy. For various reasons. So you can't guarantee this. And I, in my book, I take two examples, sort of very famous examples, of a mismatch between objective and subjective well-being. So Ludwig Wittgenstein, the famous philosopher, he said on his deathbed that his life had been perfect. He said, I led the best possible life I could have led. Everything was perfect about it. My friends, my colleagues, my students, being able to do what I wanted to do. My life was perfect in terms of flourishing. But Wittgenstein was famous for being an extremely grumpy person, always in a bad mood. So, objective flourishing didn't seem to lead to subjective happiness in his life. And then you got the famous example of the Dutch painter Gauguin, who I think nobody would argue led a flourishing life, at least not in terms of character, strengths and virtues. He left his family in dire straits in the Netherlands to go and enjoy himself philandering with local women in the Pacific Islands. But according to his diaries, his notebooks, he was very, very happy. He enjoyed life a lot, although he would never say that he led a flourishing life. So there are these statistical outliers. How much should we worry about them? Well, maybe we shouldn't too much. If flourishing is supposed to be the aim of schooling and education, then we try to enhance these objective variables and hoping that for most children they will be happy as well then. Now the fourth problem, and this has become much more vocal now. When I wrote my book, there were very few people arguing against flourishing as the aim of education. But certainly in the last 3 or 4 years, as always happens in academia, when something becomes popular, then all the skeptics come out of their rabbit holes and start to criticize the new account. So David Carr and others argue that flourishing is just too vague as an aim. And according to David Carr, what is happening, and he takes examples of these four different accounts, he would say that people are just using flourishing as some kind of a label for what they happen to value. It's like a shopping trolley. And you just go into the supermarket and then you just fill the trolley with your own values and you say, this is flourishing. But there is no cohesion in this. It's just a random choice of goods. So according to David and some other critics, this is just too bland. Everyone will agree about flourishing, but what do they really mean? Do they mean the same thing? No, they don't. So I was aware of this problem when I wrote the book, so I tried to make my definition of flourishing as specific and detailed as I possibly could. And one person who wrote a review on my book said that my account is so detailed and meticulous that it sounds like the footnotes in an insurance contract. And I didn't really know whether that's a compliment or a criticism. But anyway, I'll just read for you. This is a very complicated definition, and I explain it, in a whole chapter in the book. So I define human flourishing as the relatively unencumbered, freely chosen, and developmentally progressive activity of a meaningful, subjectively purposeful, and also objectively valuable life that actualizes satisfactorily an individual human being's natural capacities in areas of specific existential tasks, as with human beings, as rational, social, moral, and emotional agents, can most successfully excel. So what does this mean in ordinary language? It simply means that human flourishing is the capacity, the fulfilled capacity of children and all people to fulfill their potential, their overall potential. And we've got potential as rational beings, as moral beings, as emotional beings, as social beings, as natural beings. And my understanding is that flourishing is the ability to actualize this potential. And I go through each of these variables, each concept in this long definition, and try to explain what that would mean in a school context. And trying to offer food for thought for teachers and other educators. So let's continue with the problems. Some of my sort of fellow Neo-Aristotelians, they obviously love flourishing as the aim of education, but they think I go too far away from Aristotle himself in this book. So it is definitely Neo-Aristotelian with a focus on the Neo rather than sort of just, it's not an exegesis in Aristotelian philosophy. So there are certain things which I really think that we need to change about the old Aristotelian concept of flourishing if it's to become a viable ideal in contemporary schooling. First of all, I think we need to accept that part of flourishing is being drawn to ideals, to have some kind of ideals, transcendent ideals that you can be drawn to and that can fill you with awe and excitement and elevation, which is more than just curiosity. It's more than just sort of making children curious as students about life. It's sort of filling them with a sense of purpose and awe, seeing the universe. It's a bit like a person standing on a mountaintop and seeing the sunset and being filled with awe at the wonders of the universe. For people who are religious, obviously this would have religious connotations. For people who are not religious, this could be an awe of nature or human life or existence or the infinity of the universe or whatever. But Aristotle didn't really think about this. When he talked about wonder, he was constantly talking about wonder. You need to make students have a sense of wonder about the world, but for him it just meant curiosity, being curious about learning biology and dissecting animals and whatever, but he didn't really have this sense of spiritual elevation. And also, Aristotle was very pessimistic about children being able to flourish in later in life if they didn't have good upbringing in the first 5, 6, 7 years of their lives. He almost thought it was impossible. If you don't have good role models around you, parents, teachers, friends, siblings, grandparents, if you don't have these good role models around you, if you are sort of brought up in a sort of Oliver Twist kind of situation, then he didn't really think you had any chance to flourish later in life. And I think that's a bit too pessimistic, because I think most of us in this hall will know of examples of people who were brought up under terrible conditions, of maybe parents who were in broken homes, parents with drug problems and so on, but who still managed to, for some reason later in life, to go through some kind of transformation. And then obviously I also think that we need to incorporate the Enlightenment idea of human, individual human purpose. We want children to have a sense of purpose in school as well, and unfortunately surveys that have been done in various countries of the world indicate that only 20 to 25% of ordinary students at school in primary and secondary education have any sense of where their lives are going or what they aim for in life. I mean, young children might say, I want to become a nurse or a stewardess or a pilot or an astronaut, but when you speak to like teenagers and ask them where their lives are heading in most countries of the world, that they don't really have any clear sense of individual purpose. So the fifth problem is, I mean, if you are making all these changes to Aristotle's old concept, is this really anything Aristotelian anymore? I don't worry about it too much, because I mean, I'm not speaking to a group of Aristotelian scholars, but if I were speaking to a group of Aristotelian scholars, they might say, well, you are just sort of polluting the theory too much with all these modern elements. Now, I do think that this is not only a problem for Aristotle. I think this is a problem actually in many of these modern flourishing accounts as well. I think they are too disenchanted or flat, and they don't take account of people's needs to be drawn to ideals, abstract ideals of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And I even think that a lot of young people's sort of desire to experiment with drugs and all kinds of sort of dangerous behaviors is motivated by this desire to sort of feel high, to feel something bigger than yourself, to sort of experience something in a sort of awe-filled, transcendent way. And in a sense, actually, although there's a big similarity between Confucius in China and Aristotle, and Confucius also had a concept of human flourishing, actually, the Chinese concept of human, the ancient Chinese concept of human flourishing does include many much more sort of spiritual experiences than Aristotle. So, for example, in Confucianism, those of you who know anything about Chinese philosophy, they've got these concepts of heaven and the way or the Tao, which are sort of abstract ideals that people are drawn to. So I think there's quite a lot that we can learn from Asian philosophies as well, and actually OECD is very concerned about that. So when they asked me to write my report about flourishing, and I told them I would be focusing on these four Western accounts, the Aristotelian, the liberal, the SDT, and the positive psychological one, they said, that's fine, but you also need to have a chapter about Confucianism and Buddhism and the African Ubuntu philosophy, because, I mean, this is supposed to be a universal ideal. You need to be able to persuade people from these countries that these Western ideas of flourishing also resonate with them. So I sort of enlisted the help of some experts on African and Chinese philosophy as well to try to make this more universal. But that all happened after this book. I mean, it's not in the book, it's what's happened later. So I think the big problem in the Aristotelian theory is that he had a very, very strong sense of the role of emotions in a flourishing life. So he's not like, for example, Kant and others who sort of wanted to make people unemotional and purely rational. Aristotle thought that emotions were extremely important, that you need to, in a flourishing life, you need to feel the right emotions at the right times to the right people, etc. But he was only thinking about emotions that you feel towards other people, like compassion, or to yourself, like pride, or to external events, like fear at a lion that's coming at you. But there is no emotion of awe, for example, in Aristotle. He did not think about emotions that are directed at abstract ideals. He was a people person. He thought that everything you pick up, everything good you pick up in life, you pick up from role models around you, not from sitting in a chair and thinking about the true good and the beautiful. Okay, let's now talk about some more practical things. So what can teachers do about enchantment? If a teacher really believes that, yes, I want to be a flourishing facilitator in a school, what can you do as a teacher? Well, I would begin by saying that although a lot of teachers are doing a lot of good things in schools, I think there are also a lot of sort of unused opportunities. And I will just give you an example of how teachers can sort of generate these peak experiences, these experiences of elevation and awe among students in school. And I'll just take one example, which is the teaching of literature. So just to make this a little bit more personal, when my son was young, we moved constantly between countries and places. So he went to 7 different primary and secondary schools, first in Iceland and then in England. And we were very lucky in England that we were living in a nice area of Cambridge, so he went to what is considered to be the best secondary school in the whole of England. And in Iceland, he learned Icelandic sagas every year, new saga every year. And when he came to England, he started to learn Shakespeare. And I was absolutely appalled by the way literature was being taught in all these schools, by all these teachers, good teachers, well-meaning teachers. But it was, and the essays and the exam questions were all about how many people died in that battle, what was the name of this person's grandmother, a lot of analysis of style, metaphors, idioms, etc. That's maybe important for literacy purposes. But why did people write the Icelandic sagas? Why did Shakespeare write his plays? These were pieces of literature, like most literature, were written to convey existential and moral messages to people. And I think this is exactly what young people, especially in secondary school, are craving for. They're craving for finding meaning, dealing with dilemmas, etc., And literature is a wonderful source of explanation and analysis of these existential and moral issues. But I think this is a really unused resource. And I could also take examples of the teaching of physics and mathematics. I mean, mathematics is such a beautiful discipline, and physics about, you know, the infinity of the universe, about the planets and so on. I mean, these are all potential sources of elevation and awe. But a lot of surveys have shown that 95% of students around the world never experience any sense of awe or even flow in classes in literature or physics. The only classes where they experience flow tend to be sort of arts classes, where they're painting or sports. But even in sports and arts, only about 20 to 30% of students say they ever experience any sense of deep flow in the classroom. Now, one really strong thing about Aristotle, and I want to emphasize this for those of you who may think that this ideal of flourishing is very individualistic and maybe even capitalist or whatever, Aristotle was a very, very polite person. The only time in his corpus where he uses the word nonsense is where he talks about the view that you can experience flourishing just as an individual. And if you're just a good person, then you will flourish no matter what happens to you, no matter what the government is like or what the school environment is like or what your community is like. And he says this view that it's all about the individual, just looking inwards, you know, some kind of mindfulness exercises and just finding yourself, he says this is nonsense. We need a lot of external things to be right. Close parental attachment, good government, enough wealth so that we at least have enough to eat and drink, a complete life, health, friends and family, etc. So this is not an individualistic ideal, at least not the Aristotelian version of it. Right, so again, back to the teachers. What should they do if they really believe in this ideal of flourishing as the aim of education? And again, there is a big debate. How demanding is this ideal? Some people have said to me, well, if you really believe what you're saying and you really want teachers to take on this role, you are just placing too high demands on them. They don't learn anything about this kind of teaching. They just learn how to teach chemistry and biology and sport and history, and they don't learn how to be flourishing facilitators. And even people who are sympathetic to this ideal, they differ a lot on the role of the teacher, the duties of the teacher. Just to give you one example, Elizabeth Campbell is a very eminent Canadian teacher educator, recently retired. Alistair MacIntyre is a famous Scottish philosopher. And they both think that flourishing is an aim of education and teachers should be aiming for flourishing, but they've got very different views on what that really implies. So Elizabeth Campbell says the duties of the teachers are limited to the class that the teacher is teaching. If you ask the teacher to do anything more, that's placing too great demands on the teacher. The teacher should just focus on his or her own students. Whereas Alistair MacIntyre says, no, if a teacher really believes in this, the teacher needs to be an activist. The teacher needs to be promoting this ideal for all children around the world. It's not enough just to have your 30 nice kids in your class and, you know, establish a relationship with them. If you are a good teacher, you will be a political activist as well, and you will be fighting for this goal. So, and this is why actually MacIntyre says that being a teacher is a terrible profession, because he says that if you are really serious about believing in education for all children, then, and you, given the political situation in the world, then you will be so frustrated that it's better not to become a teacher. So it's a kind of a very pessimistic message from MacIntyre. But you can see these very different views on what this implies. And then, again, to become even more practical, there are also big debates among these people I mentioned at the beginning about if OECD decides that flourishing is the aim of education and, you know, require schools to sort of change their approach to education. What does that mean for simple things just like the school timetable, the school subjects that are being taught? And we get very, very different ideas about that. So people like Harry Brickhouse and Dorette de Ruyter, they think this is all about a different approach by the teacher. You can still teach the same subjects in the same way. You can still teach English between 8 and 9 on Monday morning, and then you go to sport, and then you go to chemistry. And so there's no big change in the timetable. It's just a change in teaching methods and approaches. Whereas people like John White is much more radical. He says that if you're really serious about flourishing as the aim of education, then you need to scrap this old division of school subjects, which dates back to the 18th century. If you compare the timetable of a child who went to school in England in 1823 and then in 2023, it's almost the same subjects, apart from information technology has been added. But apart from that, it's the same subjects. And he says, the world is not the same as it was in 1823. We don't solve problems on the basis of individual subjects anymore. They are solved by teams of people coming from different areas. So John White wants to completely change the timetable in schools. So he wants on a Monday morning, the children come in at 8 o'clock and they do an hour class on peace and war. Then they do an hour class on another theme like global warming, etc. So everything will be thematically organized in the school. So you can see there are so many questions that need to be answered about what exactly this ideal would mean in a practical school context. And then the teachers. It's one thing to lay out some kind of a official new goal, even if UNESCO and OECD and the United Nations all sort of write some declarations about, you know, what is the aim of universal aim of schooling, and everybody agrees, although I don't think that's going to happen very soon. But even if that happened, then are teachers really ready for this role? And people like Chris Higgins, who wrote a really good book about professional ethics of teaching in 2011, he thinks that the way teacher training is organized in most countries in the world nowadays simply doesn't prepare teachers for this role of being flourishing facilitators. So he thinks that restoring to its central place the flourishing of the practitioner is the first step in constructing a virtue ethics of teaching. And this is a very important point for those of you who are working at the university, like most of you in this audience, that Chris Higgins would say that before we start to make any significant changes in schools, in primary and secondary education, what is required first is a radical change in teacher training, how teacher training is organized and how we prepare teachers for this role of helping students to fulfill their overall potential. So, as you see, there are lots of issues left to ponder, both theoretical issues, practical issues, curricular issues, teacher training issues. But I still find this call to arms very appealing. I mean, I wouldn't have written this book in 2020 if I didn't believe that this is something that we should be aiming for. Obviously, I am very happy to see what's happening now in policy circles, although I simply worry that the only change that OECD will, in the end, decide upon is to simply add one more survey to the PISA tests, and they will just create some simple measure of flourishing, and so schools will just get a flourishing score along with their other scores, and nothing else will change. So that's my big worry. But I want to end this presentation with a call to arms. Until recently, flourishing was hardly ever discussed outside of a very small group of Aristotelian philosophers. And then after Martin Seligman's book, fairly small groups of psychologists as well. Now, in the last 5-10 years, hordes of academic psychologists, especially positive psychologists, have come on board, although their embrace of this philosophy is sometimes a bit hesitant. And at the moment, as I said, educationists, educators, policymakers are joining this party also. Some academic trends become abortive while others continue to catch on. So I appeal to you, dear colleagues, to help move the flourishing discourse forward in order to make it enrich educational policy and practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian, very much indeed. And now we have some time for discussion. And first, we have three discussants here, which have been preparing their comments beforehand. But hopefully, we also have some time for general discussion after these speeches. And we also have people there online. And also, if you are following this event online, you can post your comments to the chat, and then we will read them afterwards. But first, I will welcome Professor Sanna Karkulehto on behalf of JYU Wisdom to think aloud what she thinks about what she has just heard. Please, Sanna, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. There you go. This is the only picture or slide that I'm going to show during the speech. Can you hear me? Okay, good. So thank you, Professor Christiansson, for your insightful lecture, really, on student flourishing as the aim of education and on the intriguing question of good life and well-being of students. And thank you very much for referring to literature and fiction, and Charles Dickens in your speech as well. My feelings of elevation during my physics classes were over there only when our physics teacher showed us some Charlie Chaplin films that he was very enthusiastic about. But well, yeah, I, as a scholar who has spent her most recent academic years in theorizing such interdisciplinary concepts as planetary well-being, planetary feel, and planetary activism in the contexts of mostly sustainability science, environmental humanities, human-animal studies, feminist post-humanities, and even in the context of violence research, and also as an academic teacher who is responsible for teaching and educating the future subject teachers of Finnish language and literature, I warmly welcome Christiansson's ideas. I also hope that they will be welcomed and adopted widely in the field of Finnish and naturally also in the global field of education and teacher education, as I think that in the idea of flourishing as the aim of education, there's also potential for moving beyond individual students and their flourishing towards a larger scale of flourishing, the flourishing of this planet that we are living in. I will next cite and refer to the first full chapter of our forthcoming book entitled Interdisciplinary Perspectives on Planetary Wellbeing, and you can see the picture of the cover of the book over here. In the contemporary context and reality in which the negative human impact on the Earth system has reached a point where the future of human societies and the flourishing of life in general are threatened, there is an urgent need for reaching from human individuals and their well-being or flourishing towards the well-being of the environment, the non-human, and the entire planet. There's no other way left, really. And moreover, global inequalities among humanity itself are severe regarding who receives the benefits of environmentally damaging actions and who has to bear the detrimental impacts. Around the world, nations top 10% of earners capture approximately half of national income, and globally, the share of the top 10% of global income is about the same. Retaining the present standard of living in the wealthiest countries necessitates structures that maintain globally unequal, exploitative labor division and ecologically unequal exchange. Therefore, transformative changes to social, economic, and technological systems are increasingly called for to change the course towards a more sustainable future in both environmental and social terms. There is a need for deep systemic transformations in our production and consumption habits, and in the way people value nature and conceive a good quality of life. And in this transformation, I think education is key. The question is how to educate new generations who understand this and embrace the flourishing and diversity of life of this planet, and who challenge their current conceptions of, for example, individual and human well-being and their meaning in their everyday lives. I am a member of the National Matriculation Examination Board in Finland that makes the final assessments of the exams and tests taken by Finnish senior high school students every year. Each year, the test that evaluates writing skills of the candidates has a particular theme about which the candidates must write their essays. And this year, the theme was future. After reading hundreds of essays where Finnish high school students and are more concerned about the well-being and future of our planet than about their own well-being and their own future, I dare to say that surprisingly many people of the younger generation are not even interested in individual flourishing, but rather flourishing of the whole planet. And therefore, I would be very interested in hearing about your thoughts, Christian, on this kind of perhaps fundamental change in the framework of flourishing as the aim of education. Or, of course, I can also ask, would you regard the change as fundamental at all, or rather as a change in the focus or in the viewpoint, as maybe your example of Greta Thunberg might emphasize? So thank you very much for your inspiring talk, and still I would like you to elaborate your idea of, I think you have perhaps mentioned the concept of planetary flourishing sometimes, if you'd like to elaborate that a little bit more at some point.
Thank you very much, Sanna. And so, Christian, what would you like to answer to Sanna about this idea of planetary flourishing or planetary well-being from that point of view?
Yeah, thank you for your comments. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, once again, I come from the field of Aristotelian philosophy, and Aristotle didn't obviously have any sense of environmental disasters or global warming and so on. But I do think that a change of compass from flourishing of individual students to the flourishing of the whole planet wouldn't be a major change of compass in Aristotelian way of thinking, because for Aristotle, again, I mean, he wasn't really interested that much in individual flourishing understood in a sort of liberal 18th century sense. He was more interested in the flourishing of the society, of the community, etc. And nowadays, of course, we know that communities and societies and the whole planet cannot flourish without taking account of environmental issues. So I don't think this is a fundamental change, to answer your question directly. I think it's more like a change of viewpoint or scope. But unfortunately, academia is very fragmented, and until recently at least, people writing about sustainability and environmental ethics on the one hand, and issues related to educational philosophy, flourishing, wisdom, etc., on the other hand, have run on completely parallel tracks without much interaction. And for those of you who are interested in this issue, I strongly recommend a couple of recent articles by my ex-PhD student, Karen Jordan, who interviewed actually people, experts, both in sort of the character, virtue, values field in education, and on the other hand, people in sustainability education. And she was trying to find out what are these mutual suspicions? Why are these two groups so suspicious of each other? And she was trying to... her aim is to sort of bring these two discourses together in a way that you suggest. So that these are two papers by Karen Jordan, published last year in British Journal of Educational Studies and British Educational Research Journal. So if you're interested in sort of getting at least an explanation of why these are still two discourses rather than a single discourse.
Yes, thank you very much, and you can keep it. I really agree that, let's say, the human flourishing can only be based on what we can call planetary flourishing. And actually, it seems that also the guys from the OECD think the same. We had the meeting with the OECD guys and the people from Ministry of Education a couple of weeks ago. And actually, at the one of the outcomes of these discussions was that Michael Stevenson actually said that what if we skip the word human out of our project and we talk only about flourishing, including the flourishing of nature and humans. So they are kind of two sides of the same coin. Okay, thank you very much. So next we have the second discussant, Katja Kokko, from... I think more from the human perspective, indeed.
Yes.
So please.
Thank you. Thank you, Hannu, and thank you, Professor Christiansen, for your excellent presentation. It gave a lot of food for thought. My perspective is very individual-based, and I know that I learned that according to some famous philosophers, it's nonsense. But I'm still proud to do it because it's my evidence based understanding that it's only when humans have a good well-being that they can care about others and the whole planet. So that was my argument. So my background is in psychology. I'm currently leading a very long-term longitudinal study, which was begun even before I was born by Professor Lea Pulkkinen. And in this study, the same participants have by now been followed from the age of 8 until age of 61. And they are representative of the Finnish age cohort born in 1959. And of course, this is an extensive study, and we have many different research areas covered in this study. But one of them, I think, might be related to the presentation we just heard about, and it's related to mental well-being. And psychology has been very good at recognizing problem behaviors, but less is known about positive behaviors. Of course, in line with positive psychology, there is increasing understanding of optimal and good human functioning. In the area of mental well-being, mental well-being has mostly been defined as an absence of ill-being. And we have tried to find out what are the positive dimensions of mental well-being and have followed the viewpoint of Professor Corey Keyes, who used the term flourishing in a different way than what we have heard today. But he argued that flourishing means that one has good emotional, psychological and social well-being and lack of mental disorder or ill-being. And I think that the term psychological well-being has similarities with flourishing, might have some links. It's used as an indicator of eudaimonic well-being and includes dimensions for self-acceptance, positive relations with others, autonomy, environmental mastery, purpose in life, and personal growth. This this might have some similarities. So this is one question we have been trying to get an understanding of. But the other question is that I'm particularly interested in learning more about the optimal psychological functioning of adults and late adults. And that's not an easy task. And I really would like to learn more about how to measure optimal psychological functioning. The developmental theories concerning adult ages are quite old. They are from the 1950s. And there are so-called development tasks like generativity and integrity. But according to our understanding, they are not so relevant anymore. So would it be flourishing or something else, and how to define and measure it at the individual level? So thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you again. Well, just to clarify, I mean, what Aristotle called nonsense is not the focus on individual well-being. Obviously, he was very interested in every student and every person flourishing as an individual. He was just saying that it's a nonsense to believe that you can flourish as an individual even if the whole environment around you is not. So he thought that you could only flourish in a context that was flourishing as well. And he was talking about the political situation and obviously the environmental and the educational resources and so on. So, no, I mean, I agree with you. I think Riff's old concept of psychological well-being, I mean, obviously is broader than flourishing because he's thinking both about subjective and objective variables. And maybe that's the way forward as well because, as I said, I mean, there's a huge correlation between them. Anyway, whether the concept of flourishing is as relevant to adults and maybe older individuals as it is to children and students, well, why not? I think Aristotle would definitely have said yes. He would have said that this is the measure of how well your life is going, I mean, from birth to the grave. But just it so happens that the biggest growth industry, the biggest sort of bandwagon at the moment is obviously about flourishing in an educational or school context, and that therefore the focus has been more on primary, secondary, and to some extent professional ethics education at university. It seems very few people are interested in the flourishing of university students who are not doing professional degrees. There's a lot of research going on about flourishing among students who are doing nursing and policing and medicine and teaching and so on, but not those who are just doing ordinary subjects like linguistics or French or chemistry. So for some reason, there is not much interest in that. And again, not as much research focus on flourishing later in life as maybe there should be. But to respond to your question directly, yes, I mean, I don't see any obstacle to flourishing being the sort of the big common denominator of psychological and societal well-being through one's life.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katja.
Hannu, may I have one more comment? One.
Short.
Just one. Yes. We also know, based on our findings, that 50% of the mental well-being is explained by personality traits. So in addition to environmental factors, it's something which is quite inherent in us.
Yes, thank you very much indeed, and thank you for your comments. And then, Mira, please, floor is yours. And actually, we already have been touching about the question of individual versus social well-being. And as far as I know, Mira has a very good sociological imagination. So,
Have a go. I don't know about that. Thank you. It's nice to be here. And thank you so much for your presentation. And I also had the time to read and see some of your previous lectures. So it was really nice to see that you have already commented some of our questions earlier. And that was something that we discussed before. And you mentioned in your lecture that you have already said something about those issues that maybe have become later on. So, well, anyway, since my background is on sociology and politics of education and guidance, my field is also, and my comments are regarding the social justice, social of this whole issue. And I know that it's a little bit, I don't know how to put it, but it's not so gentle to come to the field of philosophy from the point of view of sociology, because you just kind of end up putting two different concepts against us, but I think that that is what we are here for. but I had two questions, and the first one was that I was thinking about the recognition and social justice. And we know that the students come from diversity of families, teachers, which have their own life histories, they have their education, and they live in different contexts, and the schools are located in different contexts, and we need to address that when we are teaching. And I was thinking about the idea of flourishing and how in tackles with the idea of recognizing the different varieties, and how we recognize the variety which has the impact on the readiness of the students to flourish, but also the readiness of the teachers to recognize the flourishing. So there's two questions, like how to understand the diversity, but also the teacher diversity and maybe teacher training diversity too. So it's a complex issue. And furthermore, I keep it short because I want to have some time for discussion. My field is also on youth research, and we have been doing a lot of research on young people that are worried about their lives being marketized or individualized in a way that life becomes a project. And I'm just afraid that this discourse that you kind of emphasized in the end, like the flourishing discourse, might be one of those discourses that also emphasize the individual lifelong flourishing idea, where the young people constantly need to reflect themselves and being flourished or being good flourishers. I don't know how you put it, but anyway, so the other question is that, is there a risk that the individualization becomes a project? And how can we avoid that flourishing does not become another kind of cruel and unfair way to see that the young people have to develop in certain ways in schooling? So to summarize, how can we recognize the social in flourishing, and how can we avoid it not becoming too demanding for the young people? And would it be probably like thinking about co-flourishing, like to build up in the schools, like the idea of the flourishing is not something only the individuals do, but we do together in communities or at schools. And perhaps like the social agent, I noticed that you used the social agent in your text, but it wasn't mentioned here, so I just think that it might be one kind of concept to build within the flourishing concept and its use of, in a philosophical sense. So, yeah, I think that we can continue discussion. So that were my questions, and I know that they are large, and you have already touched them in your books or the book, but if you would like to elaborate them here too. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Well, these are huge questions, and so it's really interesting, this idea of flourishing tends to be criticized from both sides of the political spectrum, and it depends on where you are, actually, where you work, which criticism is louder. So in the States, the criticism that you suggested is quite common, because, I mean, a lot of people who are writing about flourishing and character development and so on in the States, they do so from a very individualistic orientation, and they tend to be criticized from the political left for ignoring social structures and so bigger social justice issues. In the UK, where I work, actually, the main criticism on our work comes from the political right. So they think that we are too touchy-feely, and sort of they think that this new idea of flourishing is just one more, you know, liberal political left sort of conspiracy to undermine traditional school subjects. So this is really, really odd. So the flourishing idea is sort of criticized both from the left and the right. So maybe it means that we are doing something right, because, I mean, we get sort of criticisms from both sides. So I think, we in the Jubilee Center where I work, I mean, we obviously have done a lot of work on the civic virtues, and we think we cannot really sort of study the moral virtues in isolation from civic issues. So I don't think the criticism that you mentioned would particularly sort of hit at what we are doing. But I do acknowledge that there are people, I won't mention any names, but there are people, especially in the United States, who are writing a lot about character education and flourishing education, who sort of do so from what we in Europe we would consider to be sort of overly individualistic stance. The first question you asked was even more complicated about social justice. I worry a little. I mean, social justice is one of the key virtues in Aristotle's works. He talks about it in three different books, in the Politics, in the Nicomachean Ethics, and in the Rhetoric. So he's really, really interested in social justice issues. He thinks that social justice is about the common good, how to enhance the common good in society. That's his definition of social justice, anything that relates to processes or decisions that affect the common good. I worry slightly that the discourse on social justice in educational circles in the last 5 to 10 years has sort of focused more on sort of identity endorsement and sort of identity politics than the notion of the common good, and the notion of the common good is sort of gradually disappearing from educational discourse, which worries me slightly. But again, I could talk about that for another half an hour. I just want to say that regarding diversity, yes, this is one of the most important empirical findings. One of my biggest lessons in the last 10 years, working with a lot of different schools all over the world, I mean, from slums in Buenos Aires to sort of green leaf areas in England, the main lesson is that it's almost impossible to create an educational intervention that works in every school. You always have to adjust the content and the teaching to the environment. Even just within Birmingham, the city of Birmingham itself, some interventions that we have tried in some schools, which have worked really, really well there with teachers there, we try to take them to another school and they don't work at all. Maybe because the ethnicity, the beliefs of the children, you know, the background are different. So I think from an educational perspective, if we are going to make this ideal of flourishing work, it has to be adjusted to the needs of different nations, different cities, different areas, different schools, different individuals. It has to be sort of really contextualized rather than just becoming some kind of a one big idea, one big intervention that works for everybody.
Thank you very much. I took a look at if there are any questions online, but seems not to be. There's some kind of discussion, but not quite clear question. So maybe we have time for one question or a comment from the audience. So there seems to be one on the front line.
Thank you. From my viewpoint, I think that some kind of opposite is created between social and individual. It's not so important, actually. I think that one of the coolest innovation made in this field has actually been in Sweden. They have created sustainable development project, and they take into account both sides. They talk about inner developmental goals from psychological viewpoints, integrated the sustainable development. And actually, that movement has widened around Europe. It has been discussed in EU and also in United Nations lately. So I think it's a very clever solution. They take both sides together. So it's a kind of dialectical movement. It's going between two opposites, two nodes, between persons and between social groups and environment and other systems.
Thank you very much. And okay, Christian wants to answer to this comment.
Well, not an answer, but just I just want to sort of express my satisfaction, my joy at seeing people from so many different disciplines here. And I think what Eva is talking about is so important, that we get people from different backgrounds to come together. And at 90% of conferences and seminars where I speak, the people in the audience are sort of predominantly from one discipline. I'm speaking either to educationists, or I'm speaking to philosophers, or I'm speaking to psychologists, or I'm even speaking to medical doctors or nurses. So I rarely have an opportunity to see so many people in one hall, you know, with so many such a varied experience and disciplinary background. So I think you're doing something really good at this university, and I think you can play a leading role, an exemplary role in bringing all these discourses together. So thank you so much for the invitation and for the opportunity to know what you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And maybe we could go on with these discussions up to the late night, but now actually we have an opportunity to go on while having some coffee on the cafeteria. So just go directly to the dining line and say what you want, and they will give you what you want there, and then the bill goes to somewhere anyway. But before we stop, I want to advertise another event which will be held, hopefully, in the very same place here on 26th of October, and when Hert Biestad is coming, hopefully, to Jyväskylä, and talking about, once again, about what is the aim or what is the purpose of education. And he might have a little bit different answer to this question, but I don't think it will contradict a lot. But maybe some kind of different specification of what is the aim of education. And maybe you can find some kind of hint from the book cover, which is there on the display, World-Centered Education. And I think the idea of world-centered education comes very close to what we also could call planetary well-being or planetary flourishing. That's what I think. But anyway, thank you very much. Thank you, Christian, for your wonderful keynote. Thank you, Sanna and Katja and Mira, for your comments. Thank you for JYU Wisdom for organizing this, and the Ruusupuisto people for letting us come here. Thank you very much. Have a nice afternoon.